I want to highlight at least two issues and maybe a third one, depending on how well we go, related to CDSs. One of them is from the CDS buyer's point of view, the use of CDS as an economic hedge. And the second one is the CDS from the seller's point of view, and which is the use of CDS as a potential synthetic asset. So I wanted to talk about those two issues. In addition, just a quick overview of where CDS fits in the various types of guarantees and how we account for them. This just a quick slide, an overview slide that shows three categories of financial guarantees and three different ways in which we account for them. If you provide the financial guarantee in the form of a credit derivative, which is a credit default swap, then the accounting for that is basically the derivatives accounting, which is FAS 133. And that's a fairly, it is a complex one, but ultimately it's a simple idea that you basically mark the derivative to market. The other way in which you can give the financial guarantee is through an insurance contract. The other way you can do that is through simple financial guarantees, but not written in the form of an ISDA contract. And those kinds of financial guarantees are accounted for using a slightly different type of accounting, and that's FIN 45. And here again, we do report the guarantees at fair value, but the subsequent changes in the value of the guarantee depend on a different type of accounting concept, which is contingency accounting. The third kind, of course, is providing the guarantee in the form of insurance contract. And the word insurance clearly shows that that's an insurance accounting. And this goes back by a couple of decades, FAS 60. And the accounting for that is much more traditional and what we would call traditional accrual accounting. So that's just a background to show that we are, at least in the accounting world, we are still coming to terms with how to account for seemingly similar, maybe economically identical products, but currently, the accounting for them clearly result in definitely different consequences in the balance sheet as well as the income statement. The second, the other topic I mentioned earlier is from the buyer's point of view, CDS as an economic hedge. Here the problem is if I bought a CDS protection on a loan that I have given to somebody, I'm basically hedging economically my loan. So I got a loan and I have a CDS protection. So in my mind, I'm fully hedged. But when you look at the financial statements of this company that has bought this economic hedge, you don't really see the same consequence. The loan is not necessarily marked to market. It is usually reported at amortized cost, and therefore it's actually not behaving in the same way. So let's say the loan counterparty that I, the borrower of my loan, has economic difficulty and he gets downgraded, the CDS contract goes up in value and accounting requires that CDS be marked to market. So I'm going to report actually a gain in my income statement even though my borrower is going down the tube. And it takes a while to really catch up and it may not even be obvious to the financial statement reader that this company actually has a loan that's going down in value. And there are ways to compensate for that. The most recently introduced FAS 159, which hasn't gotten much press coverage, is really intended to mitigate this anomaly. And it does a fairly good job. But even here, the difference in the valuation of the loan, as well as the CDS, which Professor Saunders referred to, the difference in the valuation of those two fields continues to result in some anomaly. Here's an example where the Bear Stearns took a complete economic hedge according to their disclosure. All of their ABS CDS was fully hedged, and that resulted in a net gain on derivative trading inventory of $584 million. So what that gain says is that my assets are going down in value. That may not be pretty obvious to the reader. Right? I assume. CDS writer's side, so I'm actually writing the CDS contract. Here the main economic consequence is that when I write a CDS contract, I'm effectively now exposed to that CDS. So I've created a synthetic asset on my balance sheet, and I'm going to suffer the same economic consequences as if I'm owning that asset. However, again, the accounting and the accounting implications of this can differ whether I created a synthetic asset or a real asset. If I had a real asset, I'm going to borrow money and buy the asset. I'm going to report an asset and a liability, and my income statement also behaves in a somewhat different way. But if I instead created a synthetic asset, it's not showing up on my balance sheet. It's only showing up on the CDS, on the other party's balance sheet. So this problem is once again, the accounting standard setters are aware of this, we are working on it, but I don't really expect an immediate resolution of this one. Just very quickly, a 30-second, I know we have very severe time constraint, but 30-second, maybe a minute summary of what else I wanted to talk about. CDS is really a broader, is a part of a broader category of assets, the total return swaps. There was a small discussion of that in the earlier panel too, as you may recall. Total return swaps can be written for any kind of assets, not just obviously debt instruments. And the beauty of TRS is that it can be used to create a synthetic asset for equity instruments, physical assets, and so on. I wanted to show an example of that. Here's an example where Liberty Media wanted to acquire the assets of equity of News Corp. They couldn't do it directly because of regulatory constraints. They both are major cable companies, and you can't just go out and buy News Corp stocks without going through regulatory approval. But they were able to do that nevertheless, effectively almost in an identical way, by simply entering into a total return swap with Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch bought the stock of News Corp. So Merrill Lynch held the News Corp shares on their books. They didn't need regulatory permission. And Liberty, by entering into a TRS, got complete effective economic ownership, but not voting rights. Other than that, they got everything else. Overall, the economic or beneficial ownership is starting to gain some accounting traction. People are starting to discuss in the accounting world how to report this. Also in the legal world, it's creating some issues. For example, if I only have beneficial ownership but not real ownership, do I still need to disclose that to the SEC? This case deals with that. I don't want to go into the details, but it's worth looking up to see how it got resolved at the district court level. It also went into appeals, and at least at the appeals court, the panel didn't actually specifically comment on the district judge's opinion on this, but it's definitely worth taking a look in terms of what people need to understand regarding creating a synthetic asset and how to report that.
Thank you, Bob. One of the things that we promised to talk about today in this panel is what the current state of the litigation activity is. Most of you are aware that, as other panelists have noted, there's been surprisingly little litigation over credit default swaps and their termination. And the litigation that has existed to date largely involves disagreements between the buyer and the seller over the calculation of collateral or over the calculation of the termination numbers that the parties have to exchange with each other or pay to one of them has to pay to the other. That leads to an interesting problem, I think, that many of these panelists have views on, which is deals with valuation issues. How do you value what needs to be valued in order to determine who owes what when a credit default swap terminates? John Ray?
Thank you.
You want to